most of the time it was very, very low. The only time I did see it was when I had a grounding problem inside the shack and a mismatch with a bad balun. And I kind of noticed when I touched the radio, I was getting an RF burn during tune-ups, and I was like, So I put a field strength meter up on top of the radio, and I started seeing some deflection, and that's when I realized I better start doing something to fix the problem. But I think generally once the system is operating properly and you have a good VSWR match and you don't feel any RF bites on the system, generally you're probably okay. Case 2 QIQ.
You said a beauty there, Glenn. When in the shack you were being bitten by the microphone and you put your field strength meter on top of the equipment and you did see some deflection, what did you finally find was the cause? What did you do to make it go away, Glenn? KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the second half.
Yeah, I had a balun that was mounted on the outside of the house and an antenna tuner on the inside. And with the antenna tuner, I was able to tune the match out so I had good 50 ohms to the radio and the amplifier. But what was happening was I would, on peak ups, occasionally I would get a little bit of RF feedback in the audio and a little nip on the finger. So I set up an RF field strength meter, and what I found out was that one of the connections on the ladder line coming down to the balun, one side was loose and it came off. And I repaired that connection, and all of a sudden I found out my tuning was a lot easier again, and all the RF energy in the shack completely disappeared. KC2QIQ.
Well done. I'm awful glad I asked you this question. I've told you guys that not many times that what looks like the biggest open circuited radio circuit in the world is open wire line. 600 ohm, 450 ohm ladder line. It looks like it's got no shielding. And you compare that to a piece of hardline coax cable, and your brain says that that is very well shielded. Occasionally, you've got it backwards. Open wire line, when it's used in the balanced manner, and if you're feeding it correctly, if at this instant of time, the right-hand wire has plus 300 volts, and the left-hand wire has minus 300 volts of RF on this particular section of the 3.5 megacycle sine wave. I've stopped the energy at the peak of voltage out of the transmitter, and as long as everything is balanced, that open wire line is extremely well shielded. But if you create an imbalance, you break one of those connections, so you're applying voltage to one side of the wire and the other wire ain't getting any voltage. Now all of a sudden, you think you've got a transmission line. It is an antenna. It goes from being one of the world's best shielded devices to one of the world's worst shielded devices just because you've opened up one lead. And that's what Glenn just described to us. As I think you're going to eventually find out, Doug, the majority of what we all worry about as normal human beings is that word radiation, RF radiation. Boy, it sounds like cancer, and it sounds like nuclear, and it's far from it. 99% of what we amateurs do, unless we look down a chunk of waveguide, it is very, very difficult to exceed the American National Standard Institute recommended maximum exposure. Right now it's 1 milliwatt per square centimeter for 6 minutes. And very few of the things we do fall into that category. W2SAY, K2LIW, Glacier.
Repeater, timeout.
W2SAY, K2LIW. Glad you asked the question, Doug. Go ahead.
This is WA2SAY. Okay, thanks, Dick. I think it does answer the question. You just assume that any part of the antenna has got to be X number of feet away from any person. You calculate X number of feet from the formula that they give you in the, in the handbook or wherever it is. I haven't looked lately. And you just go from there. So, all right, very good. I think that answers the question.
So that's another good point. If you want to be double darn sure, you make a measurement. However, as long as you haven't made a great big mathematical error, the calculation of the geometry of the situation, if you assume that the RF energy is reasonably distributed along the wire of your HF antenna, and if you assume that that wire is almost a point source of RF energy when you're at a reasonable distance, or you can consider it a cylindrical source of energy if you want to analyze it geometrically that way. And by the area relationship, as I told you one example of it before, you'll rapidly come to the conclusion that unless the dipole little antenna is 6 feet off the ground, and it goes across the sidewalk, and people are walking on that sidewalk directly under it, and the head is going to be an inch away from the wire periodically, unless you do something really dumb like that. And even then, they'd have to drill there for 6 minutes, if you know what I mean. It is darn difficult, you'll finally discover, to exceed the ANSI standard. And let me drop. There is even the slim possibility that if you follow the advice of the American Radio Relay League, and if you follow the apparent advice with your interpretation of the FCC laws on this one, there is the possibility that the advice you're following from either of those two guys are super conservative compared to the ANSI report. If you've done the calculation and you think you've come up with something that sounds dangerous, if you've got the time, really dig into the ANSI report, American National Standards Institute C95 report, and you'll discover that, boy, it is difficult for you and I to set up a geometry without doing something dumb like I just described. If you stood on your fire department's 100-foot-high hook and ladder, let me drop. You stood on the hook and ladder, 100-foot-high, of your local fire department, and you convinced them to walk it up to the cell site, and you're on the top of that ladder, and you're now 5 feet away from the antenna at a cell site. And you've chosen to do this at rush hour, where everybody's on their cell phone calling their wife saying, should I bring a loaf of bread and a quart of milk home? Everybody's on their cell phone. You're staring straight into that antenna, radiating 30 watts of energy at 800, 900, 1800, 2200 megahertz. It's running full blast, and you're 5 feet away on the hook and ladder directly at its altitude, and you're staring straight into it for 6 minutes. Boy, that sounds dangerous. You go through the calculation of that, and you'll find out that that is safe. Lower that distance of the antenna to 3 feet, and you've crossed the threshold. You've now exceeded the maximum permitted exposure. At 5 feet, you're safe. I'll go over to Glenn in a minute. And because that antenna is 100-foot high, and because your house on the second floor of your bedroom is 200 feet away, and you go through the inverse square law, and everybody is looking at that cell site. Let me drop. Because it is 20,000 pounds of hardware, 100 foot high, with all these fancy doodads on top, and it's got a clubhouse at the bottom with $1 million worth of hardware in there, all cranking away, drawing 50 kilowatts of raw LIPA power or PSE&G power to run this thing. Boy, it looks dangerous as all hell. I just described an incident. You go through the mathematics of it, you'll be amazed how safe that is, as dumb as it sounds. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, go ahead, Glenn.
Dick, I think you're right on the money when it comes to base stations in most cases. I think that's where I've seen the most horrific cases, where, not mentioning any names, but it does happen, is, you know, you see somebody who takes a quarter wave antenna and mounts it on the rear deck of a car near the rear window inside the car, and they have a transmitter that's, you know, capable of putting out some sizable power, and they figure, I have to get a little bit more output to hit the repeater a little bit better, they put a little brick back there. Now they've got a brick in the car with a quarter wave antenna sitting on a metal deck in the back of the car, good match and everything else, and they keep on keying up about 100 watts right inside the middle of the car. Other situations, let me let it drop. Yeah, by the way, that's a no-no. most of us, you know, it sounds bizarre, but, you know, sometimes, you know, newbies are trying things, and, you know, they maybe want a little stealth setup or something, and, you know, they'll try something different, and that could be a problem. Other things with HF in mobiles, I've seen antennas that were mounted below the roof line of the car, and, you know, using some pretty sizable power, even in HF, and, you know, here again, you have to be careful. Make sure that the antenna systems are grounded properly. You're radiating. You have good matches. Field day, another area where I've seen places where, you know, people were running transmitters and with some power and generators and, you know, and feed lines that probably were leaking a lot more than they should be next to some open wire tuners right next to the transmitter. Another problem, amplifiers, open wire tuners. another area you should have a little bit more concern. Generally, when you're using amplifiers, open wire tuners, mobiles, it's worth a second look, Dick. K2RW, KC2QIQ.
One of the more interesting mobile operations was about 10 years ago. I don't remember the guy's call letters. He lived in Port Jefferson. He used this repeater many nights. He had acquired from a surplus sale a 800-watt solid-state 2-meter amplifier. 800 watts mobile. And he could talk to this repeater all the way to Port Jefferson. And the only problem he ran into, and it was an antenna, a 5/8 wave whip on the top of the roof of the car. The only trouble he ran into is that he had to do some heroic things to make sure the RF energy getting into the computer of the car did not give grief. And he did fairly frequently burn up alternators and fan belt to the alternator, because you draw, in order to get 800 watts out of a solid-state amplifier in 2 meters, you're probably putting 1,600, 2,000 watts into it. And so with long transmissions, as he's making these mobile QSOs, to draw 2,000 watts continuously, which is, well, let me think, on a 12-volt battery, 2,000 watts is around 200 amperes. He's asking his alternator to supply 200 amperes. Obviously, he probably had 100 or 150 ampere alternator, and so during his transmissions, the extra 50 or 100 watts was coming from the battery, and hopefully the battery had a chance to recharge during the time he's doing listening. He was pushing the state-of-the-art of automobile alternators. He got away with it for at least a year, and then, as I said, he started running into quite a few problems of burning up alternators, but that was one of the most extreme cases. Let me drop. And if you've got a screwdriver antenna operating on 80 through 10 meters, and let's just talk about the screwdriver antenna on 40 or 80 meters on the deck of your car, or mounted to the bumper. And assuming that it's an ordinary car with a metal roof, metal vertical post, and metal door, that window where your eye can look through the glass and look directly into that screwdriver antenna, boy, that looks dangerous. That round window, that rectangular window, the rear deck window you're looking through, assuming that those metal posts on the side are making good contact, that hole that your eye looks through is a piece of waveguide beyond cutoff. The diameter of that hole as a piece of waveguide is not passing a signal until you get to roughly 6 meters. Therefore, the amount of energy from the outside world, from the screwdriver antenna, getting through the aperture of that window and getting into the car is going to be extremely small. You may discover, let me drop. You may discover that your afterburner amplifier that's in the car with you, which has got a healthy 12-volt big fat red lead going through that cabinet to power this thing up to 100, 200, 300 watts, because those bypass capacitors and other networks that got into these brick amplifiers, like your Mirage amplifiers, you may discover with a little bit of testing that, 180 watts can come out of a, let me think, what's the model number of that darn thing? I'm looking at it right now, which I use for my car. I think it's a Baker 1018, I think it is. 180 watts of Baker 1016. Okay, 160 watts is supposed to come out of the thing, and mine puts out 180 watts. So when the amplifier on 2 meters is cranking out 180 watts, because of really lousy bypassing, you may find that something in the vicinity of 5 watts of RF energy is being re-radiated out that 12-volt lead. The 12-volt lead going into that cabinet thinks it's an antenna, and it's picking up some of that signal from inside the cabinet, my job, and radiating it back out that 12-volt lead. And depending on the dressing of that 12-volt wiring going through the firewall back to the battery, that amount of radiation could disturb the emission control computer in your car. So quite often, the maximum amount of energy into your car could be coming from funny places. You think it's going to come from the antenna. It may come from rather poor bypassing of that lead going into your brick amplifier. You may have some comments on that one, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2RIW.
You've covered them pretty well, Dick. It's just that sometimes it's the areas that we don't think about are probably the more likely ones to give us trouble. Is that mobiles are usually, I think, the biggest ones to give us trouble. Very well said, Dick. HYWK 2QIQ.
Okay, Doug was the guy who asked the original question. I'm going to go back to you, Doug, if you need any fills, and I hope that repeater at least hung in there. W-H-U-S-A-Y, K-2-I-W. I just went and tuned to the Eastern amplifier, and I found that it's in the non-transmitting mode. Oh well. Poor Doug. And I've been trying to talk him into putting more antenna on the roof of his car, of his house, so that he has the possibility of at least listening to the 8.5 machine. He's dependent on the 3.75 machine out there in the, out to the east of us. Alrighty, back to you, John. You make the decision as to whether we should go forward right now or we should jump over to the NASA report, the space report for Paul, WS2N. KC2WGB to make a decision. K2IW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Okay, Dick, I think we should go to Paul and the space report, and I'll just move these questions for next week. No problem. No big thing there. Let's get their space report before Paul falls asleep. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
John, you suddenly sounded very different. You sounded good, but you sounded very different. Like you were talking into the wrong microphone, or you changed rigs or something. What happened on that last transmission? I've never heard you sounding quite like that, John. Go ahead.
Is this any better? Testing 1-2-1-2.
Huge improvement. What happened?
Well, when I switched over to the other 2000, I went to the wrong mic, but they're all close to each other, so, but now I have the correct mic.
Poor John. He's down to his last four mics and three transmitters. Okay. Hey, Paul, WS2N, I'm pretty sure you do listen to the Western machine, and therefore you probably have no trouble. I'm going to double check right now. Okay. The Eastern machine is back on the air. For some reason, it was off there for a while. WS2N, what's NASA doing? K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, right now I'm going through flat-outs. So, very good. And, yeah, John sounded like a completely different person. I thought the same thing. Very good. NASA, there's quite a few things going on. Tuesday, NASA's gearing up for a test of an inflatable, saucer-shaped vehicle that will help astronauts explore Mars when we eventually get there. See, the deal is, for instance, Curiosity launched on our biggest rocket, the Atlas, and the diameter of the vehicle entering the atmosphere has reached its maximum size, so that the mass and the size of the vehicle pretty much reached its limit. So they need to have larger landing systems. What they've come up with is this low-density supersonic decelerator. They call it the LDSD. They'll test it on Tuesday out of Hawaii. And what it is it's roughly a 16-foot diameter sphere. Like a saucer shape. Similar to what you would have on an ablative heat shield. But on top of that, they've got these inflatable systems that will inflate, and it will increase the diameter to about 20 feet. And that's the smaller version. Then they have another one that's going to increase it to 26 feet. So they're working on two different types. And the idea of this is when you come through the atmosphere, it's a larger surface, and it will help slow the vehicle down. From a much higher altitude than what they can do now. So that's part one of slowing it down. Part two is they need the parachutes to be much larger. For instance, the parachute on Curiosity was 51 feet in diameter. And now they'd like to use one a little over 100 feet in diameter. Well, the wind tunnels don't handle it. They've tested it for the 50-foot diameter parachutes in. So they need a different way of doing it. So they're going out to Hawaii. They're going to take this balloon. They're going to blow it up. By the time the thing is completely inflated, it'll be probably the size of a stadium. And it's going to float this whole saucer-shaped vehicle, this LDS-D, up to a height of around 23 miles. And it's called a SAID, S-A-I-D, the Supersonic Inflatable Aerodynamic Decelerator. That's what this is, the whole system, between the SAID and the parachute is called the Low-Density Supersonic Accelerator system. So here's this balloon bringing this contraption up to 23 miles. Drop it. And on the back of the this saucer-shaped thing is a rocket. And they're going to drop the unit. Rocket's going to ignite. It's going to bring it up to Mach 4, four times the speed of sound. So it's going to get close to 4,000 miles an hour. Maybe around that number, and then the supersonic inflatable aerodynamic accelerator is going to inflate to see how it slows down. Now the reason they're up so high is they're trying to duplicate the rarefied air on Mars, and after that inflates, and the thing is flying at fantastic speed, the parachute's going to pop out. They want to see if this all works. This is the first test. They've done some other similar tests back on the ground that have been successful, but now they want to try an in-flight type of thing. What they did on the ground is they took a helicopter and took this thing up pretty high in the helicopter, maybe a mile, and they had it on a... tethered it to the ground, and it went through this spooling arrangement, and this cable was actually attached to a rocket on the ground, a rocket sled, and it would do the same thing, and it would just pull this whole setup down, see how it would work. But now they're going to try it in Hawaii at 23 miles high. So I want to see the results of this thing, because this is what they're going to need. This particular one is about 20 feet in diameter to land equipment, supplies, maybe housing onto the Mars surface. And then for the manned flight, you're going to need something that's going to be able to get back to orbit. They need the bigger diameter one up to 26 feet in diameter. So we'll see how the this whole project works out Tuesday, and I'm sure we'll be on a NASA site, Tuesday night or Wednesday, to get results of it. Another thing I wanted to bring up, this is probably the main topic for me anyway, is this company SpaceX, Elon Musk. A lot of people have seen this because it was on a lot of science websites. Had an unveiling of the new Dragon spacecraft, one that's going to be used for manned spacecraft. And they had it out in Hawthorne, California last Friday, 10 o'clock at night. Watch it live, or at night you watch it on YouTube. About a 20-minute presentation. And he gets out on his floor, and they unveil they drop the whole curtain and unveil the spacecraft, the Dragon V2 or version 2, and he explains the differences between version 1 and version 2. Version 1 is primarily a cargo version that has been used successfully docked with the space station four different times. In fact, they had one hanging over their head as they were talking, the original one that came back as a display model. But now they have the version 2, and there's a lot of differences between version 2 and version 1. Of course, it's going to be designed for manned flight. Let me drop it. WS2N, for instance, the V2 will carry up to 7 astronauts, 2 or 4 from the space station, going to dock not berthed with the space station. It could do it autonomously, with or without intervention by the crew. Naturally, you don't need Canadarm 2 to do this. That's only used for berthing systems, like the cargo ships, like the regular Dragon, or the vehicle, the H2 that comes from Japan. That's another supply vehicle. They'll use the robotic arm for that as well. That's not going to be needed. It has these Draco engines. Right now on the version 1, they have 18 maneuvering engines on board that spacecraft, and they're called Draco engines, and each one has 100 pounds of thrust. Well, they're still going to have these all over the version 2 manned spacecraft, but they're also going to have the Super Draco engines. They're going to have 8 of these things. Each one is going to have 16,000 pounds of thrust compared to the original 100 pounds of thrust. And he had a couple of engines. He showed the difference between the two engines. He had them out on the display. Now, these things are so powerful that even if two fail, there won't be any problem. They're going to use these for
repeater timeout. Repeater timeout. Cancel.
Timeout. Okay, they're going to drop out of the out of the International Space Station with a crew up to 7 people, and they'll come through the atmosphere with no parachute. And there'll be a parachute on board as backup. But as they come down, these Draco engines will fire, and it will be a propulsive landing. And the way he described it would be the accuracy of a helicopter. He could put it anywhere on Earth. So that was pretty impressive. They also had a nice video, a nice animation of what all this looks like. The Draco engines could restart. They could also be used as pusher engines in case the Falcon 9 fails when they're taking off. They could push the crew away from the failed rocket. The heat shields are reusable. You can probably use it up, half a dozen or maybe 10 times. He said Piker heat shields, the PICA. It stands for something, but I didn't write down what that acronym was for. But it's a new type of heat shield where they don't have to replace it all the time. There's a nice door right in the middle of this thing. He had a thing pour over stairway on rollers. He went up, climbed up, opened up the doorway, lifts straight up in the air. Things sitting on a deck, straight up in the air. He went inside, got into one of the seats. They had all 7 seats all lined up, and he pulls down this big panel. And what this panel that he pulls down is 4 17-inch monitors, and there's 2 sets for different things. But each one, on 2 of the monitors, you'll have the exact same thing. If one fails, you have the other one as backup. In between the 4 monitors in the middle is a whole bunch of buttons and controls and different things. Well, the screens are touch screens, and you'll be able to control everything with the touch screens to do with the spacecraft. Of course, if there's a problem and all those things fail, all these switches and buttons and everything in the middle of the four screens, they would be able to operate that manually. So it was very cool looking. And then he got out of it. Went back outside. He's all set for this. He's already made a deal with the government, with NASA. Taking a 20-year lease out on pad 39A. Dick, that was the one you were walking around on, I believe. But now, that's the one that's been used for the Apollo missions. They used it for shuttle missions. And now he's going to be using it to fly the Dragon version 2 up to the space station. I'm going to be looking forward to watching the Dragonfly. They call it the Dragonfly. It's a test version of this thing that he had, that he was showing that will actually go to the space station. And this thing's going to be tested in McGregor, Texas. This facility for testing, you might remember all the Grasshopper flights, rockets that took off vertically and came back and landed vertically. Well, then they're over with, and now they're using the bigger, full version Falcon 9 reusable ones, but instead of, they've flown a couple of them at McGregor, Texas, they're now going to move them to Spaceport America down in New Mexico. He's rented out a facility there for only $6,000 a month. So it's a bargain at Spaceport America. And that's where the new Falcon 9 reusable will be tested. They'll be able to bring that up to like 300,000 feet all the way down eventually to the ground. But at McGregor, they'll be testing the Dragonfly, and that's their test vehicle with these powerful Draco, Super Draco engines on board. So I'm looking forward to that. So I thought I'd bring that up. Two other quick topics. Yeah, Kepler is coming back online. They're going to call it K2 about 2 weeks from now. They worked out all the bugs. Instead of using the maneuvering motion wheels for changing the orientation in space, they're going to use the sun's solar action, solar wind, and use the solar panels as a way to orient it, Kepler in space. So I think you mentioned that a couple of weeks ago, and there was another report about that. And that's pretty much it, Dick. Back to that for any questions. If anybody gets a chance, go to YouTube. Again, version 2, Elon Musk or SpaceX. And you watch this 15-20 minute presentation, and they'll show you everything that pretty much I talked about. I added a few things. Back to you, Dick. WS2N with a space report.
You make it sound like you watched the program live with Elon Musk making that presentation. Was that YouTube or was that a NASA website? How did you do that one, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, it came on at 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. It was out of Hawthorne, California at 7. So I didn't see it. I had some other commitments, but I did want to see it. When I first saw it, I thought it was 7 o'clock. That would have been good. Eastern Standard Time, but it wasn't. After that, the next morning, I saw it in space.com. It was replaying it. Believe it or not, NASA did not have it, but there was a half a dozen other ones that had it. And now I don't even see it on those sites anymore. Now you just bring up YouTube, and it'll come up on that thing.
When it comes to that saucer-shaped parachute, I see a relationship between it and the science fiction movie 2010 Space Odyssey. I wonder if you considered the relationship between those two, in which it looks like, I can't think of his name right now, the guy who wrote those two movies, 2010, 2000, anyhow.
Kubrick.
Yep, Stanley Kubrick. Kubrick. He really had a darn good idea there, didn't he? And so, do you see the relationship that I see between those two pieces of hardware, Paul, go ahead?
Yeah, but of course the difference is that he was using it for an arrow braking it to go around Jupiter, and this one was, they're going to use this for actually coming through the atmosphere to, for landing, but the idea is the same, increase the diameter of the vehicle without adding too much mass, and you're going to be able to slow this thing down.
Now, I'm a little bit amazed that just by using the solar wind, and I guess waving the little paddles on the tips of the heavy arm, so to speak. Kepler, are they predicting that Kepler is going to have almost the same aiming accuracy that it had with the inertial wheels? That is beautiful. If Kepler comes back online, and up till now, I think it is the most prolific finder of exoplanets. I haven't had a chance to read one of the latest issues of Scientific American that shows you a graph of how many exoplanets were discovered each year or two. And all of a sudden, I guess the analysis of earlier Kepler data has given them a great big blast of a whole lot of exoplanets. So do you have reason to believe it's going to have the same aiming accuracy, therefore it has the ability to continue finding exoplanets at almost the same rate? WS2N, K2RIW.
I don't know. I don't think it's going to do that. This website didn't have it. I read it a couple of months ago when they were planning this, and they're not going to be able to stare at that one spot in the sky like they did with Kepler 1. Kepler 2 is going to be a little different. And they're going to be looking at other things as well. So between that and Gaia by the European Space Agency, I think they're up to 900 confirmed planets or some ridiculous number. It's just endless. And a whole bunch are in the Goldilocks zone. Some of them are now almost Earth size. So before long, they'll be looking at the atmosphere with James Webb, and they'll be able to tell you, you know, if there's methane or oxygen on board, which are signs of some kind of breathing animals, I guess. They're running tests now with Titan going around Saturn because they know exactly what the atmosphere is on that, all the different chemicals and the proportions, and you know, from all the studies with the Cassini and of course with the lander, Huygens lander that they put on there back in 2004. So they know exactly what all the chemicals that are involved. Now they're going to run tests if this thing, you know, it goes in front of the sun or stars, whatever. They're going to look with their instruments, and they've already done it. And there are some differences, some subtle differences that they didn't figure on. So, you know, they might have been looking at a planet with James Webb and said, that's methane, but not necessarily. They were evaluating.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You mentioned Kepler 1 and Kepler 2. I haven't heard about a second Kepler being launched. I'm going to make a guess. The Kepler 1 mission was the ordinary Kepler running on its inertial wheels, and now that they've come up with a scheme of using the solar wind and waving its tip feathers, so to speak, they're reorienting Kepler. And are they now calling it the Kepler 2 mission, even though it's the same spacecraft used in a different mode? WS2N, K2LIW.
Yeah, they gave it a new name, K2. But if you just put K2, you're going to get mountains. So you've got to put in K2 spacecraft or Kepler 2 or whatever. Yes, same spacecraft. They do that a lot, and they rename the spacecraft when they give it a completely different mission. They've done that with Stardust and a few of the other ones. And by the way, I looked into the Voyager 1 and Voyager 2. I know you're always interested in the gyros and the momentum wheels and, you know, to keep this thing flying right. And they really don't use them that much. How come they last 35 years was the question. So I looked into that. They have something called deadband, D-A-D-B-A-N-D, system. So as it flies, they use little blasts of thrusters to keep it at a certain point. And if it drifts a little further one direction, the star senses pick it up, and the thrusters fire, they can fire it again. Well, sooner or later, it gets to the point where hardly ever moves, sometimes for years, Dick. So they call that the dead band rotation, or you know, instead of using spinning up all these different gyros on board. Back to you, Dick. W. Weston.
There's quite a few things that have a dead band. The thermostat in your house that's controlling temperature or air conditioning has an intentional dead band. The thermostat in your refrigerator has a dead band. Thermostat in your house, if you set it at 70 degrees, as your house cools off and it hits 70, the furnace turns on, and it stays on until the house gets to 73. I'm picking numbers. But if that was true, that would be a 3-degree dead band. If you didn't do that, the furnace would be turning on and off every minute or two, which would be a little bit ridiculous. And so almost everything where you're controlling something specifically like that with an on-off function. If you had a thoroughly analog function, like if I was using I2R heating in the house, in theory I could be changing the voltage going to the heater, and I could come up with a steady state voltage that keeps the house at 70 degrees when the outside temperature is 35. But with a furnace that you either turn on or off, there's got to be a dead band. So by setting that dead band a little bit wider, they're saving on, let me drop this. They're saving on reaction control fuel, reaction control jet fuel. But there's a limit on that dead band because I once calculated what was the beam width of the antenna. At 8.5 gigs, that's around a 10-foot dish. Let me think. It's less than 1 degree of beam width. So you better have a dead band down to like half a degree when that dish is aimed at Earth. Otherwise, Goldstone is going to have trouble communicating with them. So maybe they've got a wide dead band when they know they're not going to be communicating, and they make it a narrow dead band during the actual transmissions to and from Earth. That's a guess on my part. There's one way of doing it. So you only need the precision during a couple of very critical times. The rest of the time, you can let the system run kind of sloppy and save on reaction control gas. And now that Kepler has done it with the tip feather, I'm calling it tip feather, solar wind adjusters, I wonder if James Webb is going to do that. I wonder if Voyager could do that. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
Voyager will probably keep using this dead band system. And I would think. And they, I did look into the dead band system, and they came up with, actually they mentioned thermostats for houses, and different, there's different types of ways of controlling your thermostat. There's something, they call it a hysteresis, H-Y-S-T-E-R-E-S-I-S, and it's a little bit different, and so it depends on which type of thermostat you're talking about, how they have it working in the house. But they use actually a smoke detector as an example. As soon as the alarm starts, they have a level of where the smoke reaches to a certain value, and then the smoke detector stays in the alarm position. It just stays there until the level of smoke is backed off. They call that the hysteresis system, not the dead band system. So a little different there. But on the some of the other things. Another example I came across was actually an electronic thing. You want to keep a certain voltage between one voltage and another voltage. They call that the dead band system. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, there is a word that electronic engineers use fairly frequently called hysteresis. All magnetic cores of transformers have a certain degree of hysteresis. If you actually plotted the so-called BH curve of the operation of, let's say, your 60-cycle transformer, on the positive going half of the 60-cycle sine wave, you trace one curve. On the negative half, you trace another curve. And the area in between represents the core loss. So lots of magnetic things to demonstrate hysteresis. Okay. Country Club? Was there something else? Oh, I know darn well you're not going to use tip feather solar wind adjusting on the Voyager, because Voyager has basically left the building. It is outside of the solar system, I think. In other words, the solar wind goes out there so far, and I think the solar wind has stopped, and now it's measuring galactic wind, and I don't think the galactic wind is anywhere near as severe as the solar wind. There's not enough force there, not enough particles, let me drop them.
I agree, Dick. Hysteresis, by the way, I saw the magnetic story on that, and although I read it and kind of understood it, I wasn't going to explain it. I'm glad you did. Back to you, Dick.
Quite a few phenomena in physics display hysteresis, but there ain't no solar wind out there. I think that's what they've just about measured. The solar wind has stopped, the galactic wind has started, so Voyager has left the building, has left the solar system. It's really out there, really down the road a piece. It's in interstellar space, and still going. I think it said it's still going to be talking to us to the year 2022 or 2024, and by then we'll have a few more very long baseline interferometer type radio telescopes that we can aim at Voyager. And although it's getting further away and the signal's getting weaker, we got more and more area of antenna down here. Once you know the area of your antenna, you can calculate pretty precisely exactly how strong the signal is going to be. You're going to get a very well-timed system. Let me drop.
Yeah, that's what happened already, Dick. I'll let you know in a second about the upgrades of the antennas.
Yeah, that's an area that I've got a lot of interest in. I went to Fort Irwin, the Army tank practice ground in the Mojave Desert of California. In the middle of Fort Irwin is where the Goldstone dish of NASA is located. You've probably heard the story. I went there once at 2 o'clock in the morning, and they thought I was an official, and they let me in, and had a chance to talk to the engineers. And the particular engineers on duty that night were curious as to how you convert noise temperature to noise figure, and that formula was just in the top of my head. I wrote it down for them, explained them how to use it. They were happy I arrived. So, quite a bit of serendipity there. But you may have heard the story. When I left there, I got very sick. I took a sandwich out of their machine, a roast beef sandwich, and didn't realize that the refrigeration on their sandwich machine had failed. And so the mayonnaise in there had turned into something else. And I got a minor form of food poisoning. So when I was driving back to Lancaster, California, which was probably 100 miles, as I remember, I was really feeling uncomfortable, and slept through most of the next day. Let me drop. And after that, I was pretty health, back to healthy again. But I also ran into San Joaquin Valley fever when I was out there. I'm not used to that area. I didn't have the immunity. And that's the worst flu you've ever seen. Boy, I know people who get very sick with that one. So go ahead and tell me a little bit more about what you were going to say, Paul. Go ahead.
I forgot technically what they did, but if you read the original expectations of Voyager, you know, they said, okay, it's going to go out, going to do the grand tour around the planets, and, you know, go out Saturn and all, Neptune, Uranus, and they said this is going to leave the solar system. Now, you read this back in the, you know, 1979 or 77 when this thing was launched, and they said, we'll have the possibility of keeping contact with the thing, maybe up to 2015. You know, that sounded good, but what happened was, just what you said, they'll probably do. They did improve on these, you know, the deep space network. I mean, they just did phenomenal changes, all kinds of low noise detectors and everything. Next thing you know, they could pull in signals that they never dreamt they could pull in, and that's one of the reasons they could extend it to 2024. But that's probably their final date, because they think, you know, they're losing 4 watts per year usage of this thing as time goes on, and they keep cutting back on different heaters and different things on board. So maybe that will be the end. And either that or the thermocouples will fail in the RTGs, the radioisotope or thermoelectric generators back here.
Do you have any idea, Paul, what was the rated lifetime for the radioactive thermal generators? Go ahead.
No problem. They had a half-life of 86 years, I think. They had three generators on board, three each on each Voyager. By the way, I looked at the AUs that Voyager 1 is out to. It's about to click over to 130. 129. It's going to click over very soon to, I think it was 127. Going to click over to 128. It's going to go another AU. Back to there.
And I get a kick out of converting that into billions of miles as a call signal and say billions and billions. Boy, that's really out there a piece. That's a very long piece of, very long-ranging piece of hardware. By far, that's the most way out there thing that mankind has ever created. It's going to be a long time before we launch something to break that record, though, Paul. In fact, it may be impossible to break that record. Can we possibly launch something that's going to go further and fast enough to overtake Voyager? Voyager has got a 35-year head start. I mean, when you're chasing somebody down the road, you gotta give them a mile head start and you give them 5 minutes. That's very different than 35 years of head start, where they get a gravity assist from a whole lot of planets and build up a whole lot more velocity than they could have stood a chance of doing with the rocket engines available at the time. Let me drop.
We solar sails, you got a whole bunch of them coming up in the next couple of years.
For the inner solar system, yes. There is no photovoltaic solar panels on Voyager for a very good reason. When you're that far away, 130 astronomical units, the amount of sunlight you're getting is really getting small. So there's not enough energy to run the pin feathers for orientation. There's not enough energy to run solar panels. So, you got to find power somewhere else. And solar sails, you need a whole lot of solar wind to operate those. Now, along these lines, slightly related, it turns out that there's a series of QSOs that I've had with K-A-2-Y-H-Y, Steve. He teaches physics to students at Hofstra University. And I just love physics puzzles. So we started asking physics puzzles back and forth, and we're about five puzzles downrange now. But the brand new puzzle, we came up with it last week. I think I was the major creator of this particular one. I just a few hours ago, finished up on an answer, which surprised the daylights out of me. Let me drop. And you don't have to read very far to find out that the moon is receding away from us. And it's moving at approximately 3.8 centimeters per year, which is roughly 1.5 inches. The moon moves further away from us, 1.5 inches per year. And as John says, it is moving away from us at roughly the same rate that your nails grow. Okay. What's doing that? The tides. The tidal friction, tidal bulge being slightly ahead of the lunar position is making the moon follow the tidal bulge, and it's speeding up a little bit similar to what happens when you've got a ball on the end of a string, and if you move your hand in a characteristic circular circle, you can be adding energy to the ball on the end of the string and make it speed up. Let me drop. Although there is no string between the Earth and the Moon, there is the equivalent of that. The gravity between the two is keeping the Moon in a nice circular, nearly circular orbit for billions of years. And the tide and the friction of the tide is making the Moon advance in this manner. And so here's the puzzle. I'm not going to tell you the answer tonight. A few of you guys out there know how to calculate this. And there's a couple of websites you can go to that will give you the raw ingredients. You won't find this exact puzzle anywhere, I don't think. But here's the puzzle. Assume the tide gets tired. The tide the tidal bulge on the Earth for billions of years has been adding some extra energy to the moon, and the moon's been moving away from us to a larger orbit. And now in this crazy story, the tide got tired of doing that, and the tide went on strike. But we on Earth, we like the fact that the moon is slowly moving away. So now we're going to put a rocket engine on the right-hand limb of the moon, blast the rocket engine in the prograde manner. In other words, you're adding speed to the moon, very similar to what a Progress ship does when it meets up with the International Space Station. Let me drop it. And the Progress ship dumps all of its cargo into the International Space Station, takes the stuff that they want to get rid of and puts it back in as refuse. Whatever fuel is left over in Progress, if I understand correctly, 90% of it, I'm going to say, is used for boosting the International Space Station to a higher orbit. I think you told me they boosted around 43 miles higher. I have to go through the mathematics on what that means.
So it was 14 then.
Beautiful. Okay, 14 miles, and I know now how to calculate exactly how much thrust is required to do that. Okay, so the tides went on strike. We wanted the moon to continue to move outward, so this rocket company, a very respected rocket company, let me find the name of it here. Yeah, I found it. It is the Janssen Nadel Rocket Company. So Janssen Nadel, a very respected rocket firm. They make ionic engines, Paul. Let me drop it. They make these ionic engines that have very high thrust efficiency. They can run 24/7, 365 days a year. So Janssen Nadel Company is going to manufacture this ionic engine, mounted on the right-hand limb of the moon. It's always going to be blasting in the prograde direction, the direction that adds energy to the lunar orbit, and therefore the moon is going to continue to move outward at an inch and a half per year when the tides are no longer doing it. Either the water dried up on the Earth or the tides were not strike. They're no longer doing it. They're not making the tidal bulge, and therefore we have to find some other way of doing it. Question number one. How many newtons of thrust, how many pounds of thrust must that ionic engine have 24/7, 365 days a year in order to continue to move the moon outward by 1.5 inches per year? And one of the first questions you're going to ask is, what does the moon weigh? And that's pretty well documented, 7.34, 10 to the 22 kilograms. So roughly 10 to the 22 kilograms, 7 times 10 to the 22 kilograms, is the weight of the moon. And the weight of the Earth, it's really mass, but let's call it weight, is 5.9, 10 to the 24. So the Earth is very close to 100 times heavier than the moon. But the amount of mass that they both have is known to 8 decimal places or beyond. So it is a calculatable thing. How much thrust, pounds, newtons, any units you want, how much thrust is required to make that happen? The number amazed the daylights out of me. So various people know how to calculate it. I've asked various people to make a wild-ass guess, just a wag guess. If you made a wag guess as to how much force is required to do that, what do you think it would be, Paul? I'm not going to tell you this week. WS2N?
Repeater, time out.
As I said, I'm not going to tell you this week. I'll give you the answer next week. But what would your rough guess be right now, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
I think about 10 newtons is something like 2 pounds of thrust or something like that. I forget what it is. You're gonna have to push a moon that heavy. Well, it's already moving in one direction, so you've got to match that speed. Wow, I have no idea, Dick. It's gonna be a big number, big number. And you know, not only that, it's an ion engine, so you're gonna leave this on all the time. I guess that'll cut back on the number a little bit. Well, the end result would have to be the same. If it was a chemical engine, you could launch it. You know, you could turn it on, and then when it gets to the other side, turn it on again. But it would have to be equal to the ion engine. I don't know, Dick. We'll have to think about this one. Back to you.
Hey, you said with a quick question. I'll get to you a quick question in a minute. You said with a with a chemical engine, you have to get to the other side. Very